Today's episode of The Phil Experience is brought to you by Rider Justice. Scott O'Sullivan and his team of motorcycle lawyers are nationwide and have been at this for over 25 years. I know Scott personally, and he's helped me to make sure that my policy and coverages are accurate moving into this riding season. Check him out at RiderJustice.com. Pete from Moscow Moto.
Yeah.
Welcome, dude.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And for context, we are in Pete's trailer in BFE, Moab, Utah.
Area BFE.
BFE. Is this where you had the lizard?
Yeah, we had Dusty Lizard here last weekend. So this is a really cool venue. And they had the Hard Enduro Championships here the weekend before. So it's a really cool venue. It's like 15 miles outside of Moab. Mm-hmm. And it's like nestled in this classic. You can't see it because we have all the blinds drawn. But we're in the middle of these like cool Moab rocks and trees. And there's Hard Enduro trails right on the property. And snow-capped peaks off in the distance. It's just like an awesome place to have an event.
Yeah, it was a little bit, I won't say tentative, but I rolled in here. I'm thinking... You said campsite, and I'm like, private property.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. Next sign I'm going to see is like trespassers will be shot or something. I'm just like, where am I?
They've got like 500 acres here.
So this is somebody, do you obviously know the people that own this, and they allow you to put on this event every year?
Yeah, or? For money. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They
do. Yeah, and but what's really cool is they have their own trails right here on the property, plus access to BLM land and all the classic Moab routes that go around through this area. So it's just we had 400 people out here. So it was a pretty good size event. We had a band, we had music at night. I mean, just super cool. It's called the Dusty Lizard.
Yeah.
We do four to five of them a year. And we move it around to like the really epic riding locations. So this year we're here in Moab, we'll be in Death Valley, we'll be in Silverton, Colorado, which is in the middle of like the Alpine Loop. We'll do one in our backyard in the Gifford Pinchot in Washington. And then we'll do one in Baja probably next winter. So we pick the really famous spots where like, if you're like a beginner rider, you've probably heard about them and you really want to go. But if you're like an expert rider, you've probably been there before, but you want to go back because they're just that good.
Yeah.
So, you know, like Alpine Loop, Baja, Death Valley, Moab, Baja. These are the real like marquee kind of dual sport destinations.
That's cool.
That are accessible from the Western US. So that's where, so the event is called the Dusty Lizard and it just moves around. It's super fun. It's like half riding and half like community building and making new friends. They're very, very fun.
So you're going to be in Silverton this year?
Yeah.
I want to come back to that because I have a camping experience in Silverton I want to talk to you about. But the cool part about preparing for a show like this is like, well, first of all, you kind of epitomize the reason why I started doing what I'm doing. Like, yes, moto industry, but like interesting people that have led interesting lives. Door?
The door is open.
I'll get it. Camper. I'll probably leave that in too. That's what makes it interesting. Yeah. Interesting people, interesting lives, interesting locations. Tripping over stuff. All right. Interesting people that have led interesting lives. And like, I read your bio. Obviously, yeah. I knew the brand, but I'm like, I'm on a mission to like give people a look that they haven't seen before or heard before, right? So it'd be easy to get you on here or get you on video and be like, tell me about the Reckless 40. Tell me about your innovations. Tell me about your gear, which is all great stuff. But I'm like, who is Pete, right? So if you open Instagram, a lot of times, P from Moscow, like very recognizable, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, who is this guy that
sorry
I see
about that.
On my clips all the time? And when I studied your bio and I read your blog and I watched your vlog, I'm like, man, how do I unpack all this? One thing that you said as I was setting up that I want to start with, I think is very interesting. I kind of feel the same way sometimes is we both create content. Mm-hmm. We both put our stuff online for a lot of people to see, more people see yours than mine, but the interesting part is you're like, I'm kind of an introvert. Mm. And I feel the same way. It's like, I could be in front of cameras and this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. But out in public or, you know, like I'm not a outgoing, surround myself with a bunch of people type of person.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting, especially with what you do and how visible you are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm an introvert who can kind of pretend to be an extrovert sometimes. And because of course my role is part electronic, you know, with the video work and stuff I do for YouTube and for product videos and Instagram, but then it's also part in person. I mean, we built the business on in-person contact, you know, in the beginning it was like ADV Rider was the electronic and then the shows and events that we would go set up an easy up and explain our products to people in person was the in-person part. And we're still like that. It's just gotten a lot bigger. You know, now our show tour is like a team and a trailer and we have our own booth and our own events. And, the electronic is still largely just me and my buddy Trav and we sort of work on it together. But, but to your point about being an introvert, I think that's true of a lot of people that are actually out there on social media because There's a lot of tinkering. I mean, you see, like, you know, like I said, last weekend there were 400 people. Now it's just me in this little campground out here with my right. trailer and my motorbikes and a camera. And so that has to appeal to you to really, you know, people look at Instagram and they see all the riding shots and they think, I think if you could show a pie chart of what my life is actually like versus mm-hmm. what people think it's like, if they follow me on Instagram, right, it'd be right. pretty hilarious. It's really the reverse. You know, it's a huge amount of time, like editing and just thinking about, you know, what you want to share. But to me, it's not, the electronic stuff isn't really making videos or social media. It's about communicating with, it's about communicating. It's about communicating with our customers and having a direct relationship. So I think about it less of like video and Instagram and more about like, hey, there's something I want to share about this product or an event we're doing. And the video is my tool to do it. And then the comments where people reply or the DMs they send, that's them, you know, asking questions about the whatever ideas we've put out in the video. And so those social media is just this incredible tool for having like a really direct conversations with our customers and to, for managing kind of one to many relationships where, you know, there's, I'm making the video, I'm answering the questions, but then there are a lot of people that have questions. It's just like standing up in front of a group and giving a presentation or standing next to a product in a booth. Mm. It's the exact same thing, just taken into the digital world.
And you wrote something on your blog that I thought was, yeah, ties in with that. And you said a year ago, and this, you wrote this like a year ago, so 2 years ago, yeah. your phone was full of photos.
Yeah.
And now it's full of videos.
Yeah.
Right. And you, and I think, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but you were like, you know, forums and blogs, written blogs and all that. It's kind of old school internet.
Yeah.
And now here we are in an age where short attention span clips and, you know, even 6-7 minute videos are the thing.
Yeah.
It's an interesting transition.
6 or 7 minutes. Oh man, that's like cinema.
Yeah, full production.
I'm talking 12 seconds.
12
man.
Seconds?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm kidding. My product videos are still in the 6 or 7 minute yeah. range, but I mean, which is long nowadays. But that's how it's gone. I mean, I feel like I'm like the least likely person. I fought against cameras. I used to hate going on rides with people with GoPros. I felt like they were just always like fiddling around with them and they were never working right. And the batteries were always dead. And like, yes. I was like, I never wanted to go on content trips. Like when we were doing photo shoots and video shoots for the business, I'd always try to avoid it. So I was worried it was going to like ruin motorcycling for me. And yeah. I was out a couple of years ago with our apparel designer, Scott Bryan, and we were camping off our little trail bikes and it was a brutal trip. It was raining and freezing. It was like the very end of the season and we're on single track. It was gnarly, but we were out there and he was like, it was during the week because we were product testing. And he's like, you know, we're kind of on the clock. Like we really should be filming this. And so like partway through, we're like, yeah, let's use our phones and make like a little video. And that just started. That was like the initial tug on this little thread that I've been pulling ever since. And it was like a month later, I had my first GoPro. I mean, this is just 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
3 years ago. And I'd always made the product videos for the company, but I always hated it. And I would just procrastinate it. And I would just do them in one take because I didn't know how to edit. And so they were those classic long rambling YouTube videos where it's just like, I'm just making it up as I go along. And nowadays, you know, attention spans have gotten shorter, video editing tools have proliferated and they've gotten easier to use. And now it's like all video, man. I feel like if you're not doing video, you're invisible.
Oh,
you know,
that's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. And even this is a podcast, but we're doing it on video and not, exactly. Which is not to say that there's not room out there for good writing and stuff like that. I mean, I think people got to look at, you know, if video doesn't come naturally to someone, if they're a great writer, I'm sure they can find a way to get a message out, but it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is video now, you know?
So you talked about first sort of evolution of videos, long rambling yeah. videos. I did the same thing. If you look at the equipment we have, this is like the fifth iteration.
Yeah.
I'm going to Africa. So I've been studying how to make a documentary, right? Yeah. How much effort have you personally put into like studying the craft of this?
Actually, not that much.
Really?
Yeah. Like for me, I'm not looking at it from a craft perspective. I'm looking at it like everything that exists between some piece of information I want to share and the ears and eyes of a person who wants that information is an obstacle and it needs to be like knocked down. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And compressed and consolidated and made efficient. Like I don't worry about production quality. I worry about the idea and how can I communicate it in a way that someone will receive it well. And like everything else. So like when I used to like, that's why I do everything myself. Like me and Trav do everything. We do all our shooting. We'll go out and make a product video and edit it that night and post it the next day.
Mm.
Like we shoot, we edit, we do audio, we do everything. We produce it. We decide where we're going to shoot it. We rig the bike. Everything is done by us. So there's no middlemen. We never hand it off to a third party who's got their own priorities and our own work queue that they're managing. And, you know, we're waiting for the audio person to finish the audio and the video and the cameraman to come. We don't do it that way.
Right.
We're all homemade, like cooked in mom's kitchen. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. It's like a self-published guidebook as opposed to a guidebook that's been combed over by editors and focus groups. You know what I mean? You get the personality of the creator. But I think that's what I want to do, is take all of that stuff that exists in the middle and just like compress it and get so fast and efficient with it that we can just make videos like that. Because it's about the idea. It's not about the production. When I see high production value stuff nowadays in my social feed, I think I just immediately assume somebody's trying to sell me something.
Oh, wow.
My hackles go up, you know? And so anyway, that's my perspective on it. But that, but I appreciate the craft of it. I respect it. I think it's very, very cool. Now that I dabble, I'm a total hack. Now that I dabble, I appreciate how incredible it is what people make, like the artistry of it. But that's not my pursuit. My pursuit is like, I got something I want to say or share, and I want to get it to the people that care about it as quickly and efficiently as possible with as few middlemen. Just totally direct.
Right.
You know,
that ties in perfectly. I sent this to you last night, but I had a thought of like, okay, I'm going to create a documentary. How do I do this? So I'm studying videos. Okay. In every documentary, like there has to be a main character and there has to be conflict.
Yeah.
And the character has to want something.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so if Pete's the main character, what does Pete want? And it sounds like, you know, you're trying to compress everything.
Yeah.
What does Pete want? And what's the conflict? What's the obstacle that you have to overcome in your own personal movie documentary to achieve that?
Are you asking me that?
I'm asking you that.
Boy, that's a deep question. Holy crap.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a pretty unsettled person. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm unsettled. There's not really any scenario I could even lay out for you that you could plot me into and I would say, oh, I'm happy, I'm satisfied. And so I'm restless, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why being on the road works so well for me. I've sort of been on the road on and off since I was a kid, you know, and there have been chapters of my life where I did settle and all sorts of bad behavior cropped up, you know? So I like to be on the move. So I'm fundamentally an unsettled person, you know?
Yeah.
But, and I'm okay with that. I'm 49. I've grown into it. But if you're talking business, as you said, you described me as the CEO of Moscow, which is certainly one facet of my personality. And business-wise, I'm, you know, we're very ambitious. And, I, you know, it's interesting with Moscow because, like, I went to business school. You know, I have a really weird, circuitous educational past. I don't have a high school diploma, but I have a degree from business school, as weird as that sounds. I learned all about, you know, business and money and, you know, buyouts and valuations and shareholder equity and maximizing shareholder value and all those things. I studied with all my fellow investment bankers and consultants, and I understand all that stuff. You know, I worked as an investment banker for 4 years, so I'm familiar with it. I'm also, I live in a little outdoor town called Hood River, and I'm kind of familiar with the lifestyle companies, you know, where you have an owner who's sort of like, just really focused on supporting their lifestyle, whatever that is. And the business is a source of income, or free time or whatever. And I don't really want to be either of those, you know, like I always bristle when people describe us as a lifestyle company, but I think there are other versions of companies out there, you know, like I also like the thought of these kind of private equity owned, you know, businesses that focus only on shareholder value and EBITDA and all that stuff are kind of gross to me also. You know, and they usually fail in the long term of those businesses where that's really all they have at their soul. You see these incredible companies that get handed over to, you know, so-called financial professionals and they just destroy them, you know? This is a roundabout answer, but we're a very, very ambitious company, but I think our ambition is not really encapsulated in our EBITDA or revenue or budgets and things like that, like the corporate company. And it's not really encapsulated in sort of free time and supporting a lifestyle either, like a lifestyle company. I think our ambition is like product focused. It's design focused. It's creative, you know? So like when we think about where we want to be in a few years, we think in terms of product categories and individual products, you know, in subcategories. Like, okay, we're going to do a touring jacket. How do we make the best fucking touring jacket? That's an incredibly motivating goal. And you don't have to be thinking about EBITDA or, you know, thinking about your lifestyle when you pursue that ambition. Does that make sense?
That makes
sense. So like we're ambitious as shit. We're competitive, but we're not competitive like a bunch of, you know, investment bankers. You know what I'm saying? We're competitive in the product sphere. And like when we set out to do something, you know, we definitely don't always get it right out of the gate. And we're like quick to recognize that. And because we sell direct, like if we make a product and people aren't stoked, boy, we get that message fast.
Right.
I mean, that phone starts ringing immediately, you know? And then we're like, oh shit, we screwed up. And then we take that information and we're like right on it, you know, for the next order. And so we're very ambitious, but it's in that sphere. It's in the product and creative sphere. And yet I feel that, you know, that's it. There's like a tension to be balanced there between all of those goals, because you do still need to run a successful business. You got to make money. You got to generate EBITDA. You got to meet your commitments, make your payroll. And also you got to have a life. So you balance all those things, but does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And you flashed or triggered a memory. I watched a reel, Elon Musk. He was talking about MBAs and he was like, you know, you're saying the problem with MBAs, and fast forward to the end of the reel, he's like, why don't you just focus on making your product or service better?
Yeah.
That's it. Like, that's it. Less meetings, less this or that. And I know I'm oversimplifying it, but I think what you said resonates with that sort of mantra.
Yeah, I think that's true. And he's an, you know, controversial person, but an interesting example.
Yeah.
And also someone who talks very, very directly to the world through, you know, his Twitter and things like that. But it's another interesting thing that exists nowadays is like business leaders speaking directly. You know, it used to be the business leader hid behind many layers of assistants and marketing and departments and middle management. And now people are out, he's out talking.
Right.
Know? It's interesting.
I love how you tee that up for me, because part of that was going to be, you know, your title, CEO, right? Yeah. So I've interacted with a couple in my career, and I always found them, like you said, layers, or if you meet them in person, they're almost sort of aloof and distant.
Yeah.
Or a false sort of like, hey, how you doing? High five, right? But it's right. Like, that's not who
it's
you
fake,
are.
Yeah.
It's totally fake.
Yeah.
So within your title and within your company, like what, and you obviously spent time in corporate America, how do you want to shape the vision of what you are in that role?
Well, it's changing all the time. And the reality is, like, you know, Moscow, I actually hate the title CEO. Somebody has to hold it.
Right.
But I sort of hate it. My other title is co-founder and crash tester. And I actually have business cards that say that. And that's normally what I hand out. The CEO cards are for like vendors and stuff. Moscow doesn't need a whole lot of CEOing. You know what I mean? We're not a huge company, first of all. You know, we're not as tiny as we used to be, that's for sure, but we're not huge. But we've built a team of individuals who are just like incredibly self-motivated and self-managing. And that's what we look for. You know, we're not a business that's a bunch of sort of boxes on an org chart with numbers in them, and somebody comes and joins the company, takes over one of those boxes, and we hand them a book of SOPs and say, follow these. This is like, when you come in, like, we don't want a number, we want a person. So like, if you come and join our business, it's like, you're going to do the role your way. And when you're done and you find a solution, it's going to have your fingerprints all over it. And that makes for a very interesting looking business, you know? And so in terms of my role, as a CEO, I really love working with people who don't require a whole lot of top-down management. Mm-hmm. And I think we've built an entire company of that, which is a wonderful feeling. And so I don't know what I would do if I sat around the office trying to CEO all day. You know what I mean?
Right.
We need a little bit of CEOing, you know, and a little bit of leadership. And then outside of that, you know, I'm like, well, now what do I do with my time? And I want to do the thing that is the most valuable to Moscow. You know, I put my hand on an oar too. And for me right now, that means video. But this is probably a chapter in the company's history. Like I joke that I want to be like the Colonel Sanders, you know, for Kentucky Fried Chicken. I'll be that for Moscow. But at some point you got to move past that. You look at like Revzilla and Anthony, I'm not close to the behind the curtain story at Revzilla. I just, as an outsider, like everybody, have seen, he used to do all the videos and now he's gone, and other people do the videos, but he created the model.
Right.
Know? And I don't, when I look out 5 years, I don't really see myself making all the product videos anymore. I think we need a team making videos. So I'm sort of pioneering that model, but the next evolution of this is like getting some other people trained up on doing it, you know, and that'll be my job, is to help them.
Mm-hmm.
I think
you kind of, you glazed over it, but it was huge. What I heard from you was, so I'm a big proponent of tell me what to do, not how to do it.
Yeah.
Right. And I love that in a, you know, executive who speaks that and says, we need to live this, because in my experience, and I can't speak for everybody, but it's tell me what to do and how to do it and I'm going to put like 20 reports on your desk and eight bosses so you can prove how you're doing things our way. And I would say that probably contributes a lot to the success and culture of your company. Like, cause I'm like, hey, tell me what to do. And if I'm terrible at it, then maybe I shouldn't work here.
Yeah.
But otherwise I want your fingerprints all over it. And I think that's refreshing to hear. And that's super cool.
Yeah. I think if you come take a job, I want to see you do it your way. I want to see what your way looks like. And I think that that's the same way we do motorcycle trips, you know, like when we go out as a team and ride, like we have one meeting before the trip starts and that's it. There's no like morning kickstands up, whatever time people can figure out who they want to ride with, what route they want to take. And that's the same way we run the business. And that appeals to a certain kind of person. That doesn't appeal to everybody,
right?
You know, and there's also a certain personality that will try to take advantage of that. And so you have to watch out for that too in a company. You know,
what personality is that? I'm interested.
Well, if you're not going to provide a lot of top-down oversight, that creates an opportunity for abuse. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Somebody might feel like they can get away with anything.
Right.
And so you have to watch out for that. And because that's poisonous in a little company. I think this running a business this way gets a lot harder when you get big. You know, size ruins everything. Mm. You know. And so that's something that like you, one of the benefits of being at a small company is that you can run it like that. You know, at a big company, you do kind of at some level, if you want to organize 10,000 human beings in a common cause, you do kind of need boxes and numbers and SOPs.
Right.
You know, but when you're a small, creative, product focused company, then you can run it this way. And it's a lot more fun. And it provides a lot more space for everyone in the company to be themselves, you know? And I think the sum total of that, the outcome of that is a more creative product, which then succeeds in the marketplace. You know?
So how much is enough then, right? If size ruins everything, which I think it does too.
Yeah.
And you love innovating, you love creating, you're going to be a victim of your own success, right? The company's going to grow more products, more people. How much is enough?
That could be. Well, this is enough right now.
Yeah.
I mean, enough if, you know, like people always say that in business terms, like how much money or whatever. Shit, I got enough money right now. And I don't even have that much, but it doesn't take much for
right,
me.
Right.
You know, like but how much, how many product categories, how many killer products? Yeah, I don't know. That's it. That is an interesting question. And it's something that we wrestle with sort of, you know, I mean, at Moscow is like, we have to face some of those questions because our ambition on the product side is like a little bit insatiable,
right.
If I'm being honest, I can't really imagine us running out of shit that we want to create. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have a great answer to that, but I think, I see this more and more as I get older and we talk about being unsettled and like contradictory goals for the business and stuff like this. This is a really central one, you know, is, that if you're successful, success and growth tend to go together.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you get better without necessarily getting bigger? And we face, even with this event series, the Dusty Lizard. You know, we're now in our second full year of official Dusty Lizards, really our third year of Dusty Lizards. And it's kind of grown up and people have come and had nice experiences and more people are going to want to come. But just like a town or a ski hill or a trail or a restaurant, growth can totally change the vibe. You know, what happens when you get above 400 people? Suddenly, what does that imply for the type of venue you have to choose? You know, are we just going to go around to fairgrounds?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And so like, yeah, how do you control that? Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer. But I do think there's an optimal size for a business. And I could tell you, I couldn't peg it on revenue. But I think if you interviewed a lot of entrepreneurs at the end of their career and asked them to reflect back on their favorite years, they would have a favorite years. And it probably wasn't at the end when it was at its largest. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Because we talk about, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called the rocking chair test. It's, you know, think of the age. I'm 85 years old. I'm on my porch in my rocking chair and I'm thinking back over my life, over your life. And it's like, what are you like, man, I really enjoyed that, or that made me successful, or that put love in my heart, or whatever it is. And I would think it's not about how much money I made. Probably the people that I shared it with, my family. I saw another reel. I love watching reels, but they asked this billionaire, like, what made you successful? And he was like, when I'm this old, my kids still come to see me. Right. So we can talk about products and money and CEOing and businesses and all that stuff. But I think when you're in that rocking chair, I mean, what are you going to reflect back on and be like, that's what it was?
Yeah. And for me, like, you know, I'm not married. I don't have kids. Mm-hmm. I don't plan to. And so the business is all of that for me.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's much more than just numbers in a spreadsheet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we can talk about what drives you, all the things. But I'm more interested in what scares you professionally and personally. I think you can find out a lot about somebody when you're like, it really scares me. And scare is not like, I'm afraid for my life, although sometimes I am, but mm-hmm. personally, I'm absolutely afraid of, being alone. Mm-hmm. Like I need somebody in my life. I have a great girlfriend right now. She's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you acknowledge and you're vulnerable and you're like, these things absolutely terrify me. And there's other things too, but I think that says a lot about a person. I think we can dig. You say, well, what motivates me? Well, I wake up and I hit a freaking cold plunge and I go work out and I lift weights and I do all the things, right? And I read a book, run a marathon. I'm like, oh, great, man. Cool. But when you're vulnerable and you can open up and be like, man, this is the stuff that's my blind spot or that I'm not good enough at, or I'm afraid. Like, for example, this podcast that we're doing right now, every day I have anxiety and I'm like, is it going to be good enough? Is anybody going to care? Mm-hmm. Driving up here, I was reviewing my notes. I'm like, I hope I do this right. Mm-hmm. Right. What are some of those buttons in your life?
Well, I think I worry a lot about letting people down, you know, about letting customers down, like putting out a product that doesn't fulfill their expectations, or letting our team down, like making a bad business decision or an irresponsible decision and having a financial consequence of that results in layoffs or, you know, things like that. I worry a lot. I'm a little bit of a pleaser. You know, like I want people to be stoked. And so I worry about that. That's something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably, you could just apply that to any part of my life and say, yeah, that's where my fears reside, letting people down. You know, and because of that, you know, I worry about making a bad decision. You know, I've made plenty of bad decisions and things in my business career that had real consequences, you know. And I hate it, even though I know it's part of it, you know. And then in a maybe less vulnerable, less interesting way, I worry about getting injured, you know, because I spend a lot of time on a bike.
Right.
And I worry about what that would. I've been injured also a lot on motorcycles, by the way. But what would a serious debilitating injury, you know, given my age and the amount of time I spend on bikes and have spent on bikes and the places I travel, what would happen if I was to get injured in a way that I was unable to ride, you know? And then what would that mean for my role in the company and stuff like that? And probably comes back around to letting people down or, you know. Yeah, I care really deeply about our team and about our family out there, like our tribe, you know?
Right.
Like I want to have a positive impact on people. Yeah.
What's your, you know, we talk about it, the fears, mistakes. Do you have any like big regrets? And I'll start with one too. I'll kind of tee it off. I lost a lot of years to ego. One of my biggest regrets, you know, how much money I'm making, whatever the title, and I didn't make a ton of money, but the title I had, right? I look back at that person, I'm like, my God, what happened there? A lot of regrets surrounding that. But, you know, it kind of led me on the path I am now.
Yeah.
But, you know, in your own personal life or professional life, do you have any big ones?
You know, I can't honestly say regret is such a weird word. And like, you know, when people say, oh, well, it all got me to where I am now. Like, I actually do believe that. I really think that. I feel that. But like, have I made a lot of missteps? Yeah, for sure. You know, I got out of, I mean, shit, you could go way back. I don't even know where to start. You know? I mean, sometimes I feel like my life is just connecting one failure to the next.
Yeah.
But like in recent history, you know, I bought a business a long, long time ago and right out of business school and ran it for 10 years and it did amazing for 5 years and then it did absolutely horrible for 5 years. And it was very, very painful chapter in my life, you know, layoffs and missing, violating bank covenants and not fulfilling board expectations and having to essentially dismantle the company that I'd built. And it was just really terrible time. And so, you know, of course there are all sorts of things from that decade long chapter that I look back and try to haggle with myself in my head. What if I'd done this? What if I'd done that? Do I regret any of that? No, I really don't regret it. But do I feel ashamed of some things or decisions I made and stuff like that? Sure. And then, you know, with drugs and alcohol too, I'm sober now. I've been sober for about a little over six years, but, boy, I've done a lot of crazy things under the influence. And you know, probably there's definitely some regrets in there, actually, maybe a little too personal for this podcast, but, but I'm happy now that, I got to have all those. There were also lots of good experiences too, and lots of wild experiences, you know, and, all those are part of my resume too. And I don't regret it from that perspective, you know, and now it's neat that I got to do all that. And now I get to be this, healthy and sober and a different outlook on life. And I figure if I don't drink or get high from now until the time I die and I live to a ripe old age, then if you just take an average of my consumption over my total life, it'll be almost like a normal human.
Right, right. So you talked about the business and you talked about how I read about you were like, I got on a motorcycle and went to Panama. And that was sort of the inception, right, of this. Was it just a decision? Like, after all of whatever happened, it fell apart, or you decide to step away, you're like, I'm going to Panama. Like, what was about Panama that made it?
Well, it wasn't actually, I was actually headed to, I was kind of headed south.
Okay.
More so than Panama. I was just headed south in an indeterminate length, you know. And it was mainly because I was burned out. You know, I'd had this incredible kind of run where dropped out of high school to and living out on the road and out on the streets and then coming back and returning to school and getting a college degree and then working as an investment banker and having the company grow and be successful and then getting into a prestigious business school and getting a degree and getting out and buying a business and things starts going to the moon like right away. And I'd had this like streak, you know what I mean? Where it was like, just seemed like everything I touched turned to gold. You know, and then suddenly it just flipped, you know, and suddenly it seemed like I couldn't make anything go, you know, and it just like no matter what I tried, it seemed to fail. What was the question again? I forgot.
That's okay. Why Panama? Why? Oh, so where I'm going with this is like to do that, right? Because people get caught in the matrix, right? Yeah. And I don't say caught, but it's like that's the only choice is like, well, I got to make this work. And you're like, I'm unplugging. Going south.
Right. I was trying to lead up to like, so I was fried.
Yeah.
I was fucking fried.
Yeah.
You know, when I got to that, when I finally got out of that business after having that 10-year streak and then just like crushed for 5 years where it seemed like everything I touched turned to shit, you know? And so, so I was like, just didn't really know what to do. And I was able to do it financially. And I was like, I'd been doing a lot of big international motorcycle trips for quite a while before that. And I was like, fuck it. This is it, man. I'm just going to get on my bike and go south. And I don't know what's next. You know, I was drinking a lot then too. And I just headed out and just was like, what's going to happen? I don't know what I'm going to do next. Everything. I couldn't get excited about anything. Anything I thought about doing next in my career, I was like, there's just no tingle, no fire. You know, it was like, there were some things I could have done that would have been very logical ways to make money or next steps in my career. Or, and whenever I thought about them, I just got like a little nauseous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I headed out on this trip and it was on the trip. There was a company based in the gorge where I live in a small town called Dakine. They were a big bag manufacturer and it's a small town. So they were a big deal in my little town. And so I knew that there was kind of a cluster of bag making expertise there. And I got introduced to Andrew, who's now my business partner. He's an industrial designer and he was their senior bag designer at the time. And I was out traveling, on this trip and we started communicating about the idea of like, the question I was asking was like, okay, you know, why is there such a huge difference between the stuff that you can get for backpacking and mountain biking and stuff like that versus what you get for motorsports? Motorsports is like Cabela's Bass Pro level quality.
Right.
And you know, then the outdoor is like REI stuff, you know, like Patagonia, Arc'teryx, North Face. Wouldn't there be room to do something like that in motorsports? He rides too, Andrew.
Okay.
And so that dialogue actually happened while I was traveling on that trip, that initial dialogue. And that ultimately became the seedling that grew into Moscow, you know? So, so that was what happened. So you asked me about, you know, why, what I was doing then. I was headed out I didn't know how long I was going to be gone or where I was even headed. I probably would have got to Panama. And if I hadn't gotten in a terrible crash in Honduras, I probably would have continued on down into South America. But as it was, the trip ended short and here we are.
You wrote about there's something geographically, how do I say it, satisfying about reaching the pointy tip of a continent.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think that's why Ushuaia is such a desirable destination, you know, mm-hmm. or for that matter, Prudhoe Bay, or what's the one in Canada? Tuck. But yeah, people love those, you mm-hmm. know, just like reaching the tip, you know. And some boys, South America has the most dramatic one. But right. Same with Cape Town. And, mm-hmm.
you know. Have you done Prudhoe Bay?
No, I haven't actually. I worked in Alaska for 3 years in the fish canneries. And never, I think I originally went up there thinking I would go up to Prudhoe Bay. I was going to hitchhike. This was a long time ago. Right. And I ended up getting up to Alaska and running out of money. And I just ended up in the canneries like everybody else.
Right, right. Yeah, that's on the bucket list, Prudhoe Bay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could have your pick, and you might have your pick, optimal bike to go from, say, here to Prudhoe Bay.
Probably it's a big bike.
It's a big bike.
Yeah, it's a big bike because you got to cover some miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be pretty hard to do that. And, you know, ride gnarly terrain all the way up there is just not practical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you'd get on a GS or something, you know, probably nothing smaller than an 890.
Yeah. And there's like, is it August, September? I was reading. There's only a couple months of the year. You
probably. Wanna... Yeah. I'm not an expert on Prudhoe Bay, but I think there's a lot of, just like getting to the pointy tip of South America, there's a lot of, straight, not particularly interesting riding to make it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, but when you get there, then you're like, wow, I'm on the tip of the world, you know?
Yeah, that's really cool. Accomplishments on motorcycles. Do you have any? Because you've ridden all over the world.
All over the world,
yeah. Are there still places that you want to go that you haven't been?
Oh, yeah. There's no end to it. Yeah, I mean, I'm like, you know, one of the things is I travel mostly in the winter. So that means there's a hole in the U.S. winter, which blocks off a huge part of the globe in terms of what's accessible. Hmm. So I'm particularly enchanted by those places because I've just never really had the opportunity to go to them. But I also just love every trip I've done in Africa, and it's been a lot now, and I just want to keep going back, you know.
Yeah, let's stick to Africa a little bit because I'm going to Namibia.
Yeah,
cool. Have you been there?
No, I haven't. Yeah,
yeah, so I'm going to Africa, and you know, I would say it's a little, I'll say intimidating. It is a little intimidating. Yeah. So 40-hour flight.
Yeah.
You get all the stuff. You're going to another country, and I'm doing the online research, and I'm super stoked about it. But it's not the U.S. It's not anything close to the U.S., right? Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff trying to kill you.
Yeah.
So I just think that's super fascinating. Where have you ridden in Africa?
I've done a bunch of trips there. I mean, I've ridden in South Africa. I've done a bunch of trips in East Africa. I was just in Kenya and Tanzania, but I've ridden also through like Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Ethiopia, West Africa, like Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Liberia, Sierra Leone. I've done a bunch of trips there. Yeah,
that's a bunch.
Yeah, yeah.
Not one place. Yeah. I'm going to Namibia. No. You're like, I've ridden the whole continent.
No, I haven't ridden. There's so much. That's the thing. There's so much. It's so huge. Wow. And every country is so different. And every valley can be different, like in the more tribal areas. I just think it's a really neat place to visit. And I think there is a collective global fear of the quote unquote dark continent. And that's an interesting fear to like pick apart and say what's truly at the root of that. But I think going to Africa is like really eye opening. And probably if your perception from here is that there are a lot of things trying to kill you and a lot of threats, it'll be really eye opening to go there and realize how awesome and friendly and interesting and inviting.
Wow.
And actually how comfortable you feel there after a couple of weeks. But don't, like, you know, owning those feelings you get when you first land and like really dissecting them is super interesting.
Yeah. And I was talking mostly about the animals. Cause I was reading a bunch about, they're like, don't get between a hippo and water.
Yeah.
Like, or like, you know, a rhino or a lion or something. I was like, man,
but that probably won't happen.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? That's there's just so much. If you thrive on an adventure and exploration, you know, there's just a lot in Africa, you know? And I think one of the coolest feelings is going to a place that makes you nervous and then getting comfortable there.
Oh yeah.
And Africa offers that in spades, you know, like it's like, there's just so many different places that, that you can go and have those experiences. And it's like, it might be literally just picking a country that's has a history of instability or, you know, State Department warning or something like that. And then going there and realizing like, wow, this is great, you know, and just like making friends and kind of exploring it. I don't know. I just like facing some of those fears and conquering them and then having a good outcome. That's a great cycle to repeat.
I like that. I think I actually wrote it down. I highlighted the word anxiety because I was thinking about your travels, and I was like, he's everywhere all the time on motorcycles all around the world. And, you know, we talk about social media, we talk about 24/7 news cycle. There's so much to make you anxious. There's so much to be afraid of, I guess you could say. And you wrote in one of your blog posts, oh, a normal year, you know, wars and monkeypox and all the things. And it's like, one could sit at home and be like, I don't want to go anywhere because of this thing that's happening or that thing that's happening. And, you know, I kind of want to isolate. And you're like, nah, I'm going to embrace that. I'm going to go all over the world. I'm going to travel. And I think that's something that would initially make a lot of people very uncomfortable.
Yeah. One of the things I talk about or I think about and have like bounced off of with a bunch of other travelers is like this, because like you can't be all Pollyanna. Like there are bad things out there in the world. Yeah, bad things do happen to travelers. There was a horrendous story of a couple motorcycle travelers in India just a few weeks ago that was all over social media. And you know, these things happen and we know they happen, but they don't happen as much. You know, when the human brain can't like accurately assess a risk, it tends to like vastly overstate it, whether it's a shark attack or an avalanche or a plane crash. Like if we don't really internalize, if we can't totally get our heads around the actual risk, then we just blow it out of proportion. And so there are people who see the whole world as threats and every trip as a tactical, you know what
right,
I mean,
right.
Situation. And then there are others who maybe are just totally Pollyanna and just sort of flit about and wander into dangerous situations. And I think it's one of these, it's like a existential type of thing. It's like, or somehow you have to like, it's like you have to say it's risky, but I go anyway.
Mm.
It's not saying it's not risky, you know, although I do think the risk is vastly overstated for most people, but you, at some level you can say, okay, let's try to get as accurate as we can with the risk and then say we're doing it anyway, just like riding a motorbike, you know, like, or any of the other stuff we do, you know, like that's ultimately, I think what it has to get to is like, let's cut out all the bullshit, get it down to some feeling about what the actual risk we're talking about is, and then say, okay, I'm good with that. And I do acknowledge that I might crash. I might get hurt. I might get caught in the middle of some kind of conflict that I don't understand. But I'm going anyway, you know? That's where I'm at with it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be somebody who's out there just saying to the world like, oh, just do whatever and go whatever. You know, nothing bad will ever happen. Yeah, you totally get robbed, beat up, whatever. That happens, by the way, in a lot of places, much closer to home.
Right.
But that can happen, yeah. But also, I don't think that looking at the world as just like a threatening place, I mean, that fucking sucks. Then
yeah,
what?
It does. Yeah.
Sit on your couch, you know?
There's a lot of people who do it.
Yeah. There are, yeah. Being afraid of the rest of the world, that's terrible, man. I mean, you can be afraid of the rest of the world and that can send you towards a different outcome that you ought to be more afraid of, which is not doing anything, going anywhere. That's also super risky.
Absolutely. You
know? What an uninspired life. So like, I don't know. I think at some level, just like all this stuff, you got to say, yeah, cool. It's risky. I'm good with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey guys, it's Phil. You can make sure to support this channel by liking, subscribing, and do me a favor and leave a comment below. I'll make sure to respond to it. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the episode. I think it's good to assess it. Do a little bit of research. Okay. It's this. It's that. Yeah. Okay. Now at least I have a little bit of knowledge instead of, like you said, Polly, and I'm just going to insert myself and whatever happens, happens, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Control a little bit of it.
I mean, I think it's a fact that if you go out in the world and make yourself vulnerable, you're far more likely to invite good things than bad things. And I mean, way more. I mean like 99-1.
Wow.
If you put yourself vulnerable in vulnerable situations out in the world, what actually enters your sphere is positive. It's people who want to help. It's people who are friendly. People who invite you to come crash on their couch or help you get your motorbike fixed in the middle of nowhere or throw it in the back of their truck and take you to the next town. And that's what actually comes in, not people attacking you and kidnapping you and robbing you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and I, to me, that's not rose colored glasses. That's a fact. I mean, that's based on, you know, decades of personal experience,
right?
Like putting yourself, what we're ultimately doing is being vulnerable out in the world. And if you do that, you know, you find that most of the time what comes in is good.
I love that. I think the perception versus reality, and you are somebody that has experienced the reality and you're like, hey, look, that perception, even when I said like everything's trying to kill you, because I read up on all these animals, like actually it's probably not going to be the case when you get there.
Yeah.
And you can sort of, pull that apart and say, here's the perception a lot of people have. Here's the reality because I've experienced it. And I'm setting this up because I'm pivoting right now to something that you said in your vlog on camera. And I was actually driving out, so 6 hours driving out here. I was like, oh, that's cool. He said it. So I driving, but listening to YouTube, and I listened to probably 4 or 5 videos because you're like, and we're going to Burning Man. Mm. It's like Burning Man, Burning Man. So I've known a couple of people that have done that, but their perception is,
yeah,
well, you know, the perceptions, right? And it generally casts in a negative, weird light.
Yeah.
And so I just went in deep, and they had the 10 principles of Burning Man. And then you were like, well, I've been going there for 17 years. I'm like,
yeah,
this is not what I thought it was at all.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
What do you think, having been there for 17 years, because you just sort of dispelled the myths of Africa to me. You're like, yeah, hey, man, it's probably not this, probably not. More good things than bad are going to happen to you.
Yeah.
How would you encapsulate Burning Man in that? Like, if you could, like, it's a big thing. You've been going, but like, you know, all the misconceptions, all the bad perceptions. But you're like, dude, it's a totally positive experience.
Yeah. I mean, it has been for me. And I don't really, you know, I love Burning Man. I've had great, great experiences there. That's why I keep going back, and I put so much into it. But also I don't want to sound, it seems so trite for like another business leader goes to Burning Man, you know? So I don't really consider it my job to like convince people either, you know,
right,
or to correct their misperceptions. But I do think that, that overcoming, absorbing all that information, filtering it, and overcoming those mental hurdles, is the first step to actually going and engaging with the community.
Hmm.
And, I think you, at this point, Burning Man is so big and has been around so long and attracts so many different people that if you have a bunch of preconceived notions that you'd like to, fulfill or that you'd like to prove, you can certainly go to your Google search bar and find whatever evidence you need. Right.
Yeah,
so if you want to say it's a big, you know, hippie fest, go to Google. You'll find the images to support that. If you want to say it's a gutter punk, you go to Google, you'll find those images. You want it to be a swinger orgy, you can find that too, or a drug fest, whatever.
Right.
But I guarantee you that all of those, you know, like preconceived notions can also be equally disproved.
You mm-hmm. know,
it's a very, very unique thing, Burning Man. And I don't have a great, there's not a lot of great like models to point to and say, oh, it's like this or like that. It's if 90,000 people go, they have 90,000 different experiences. It's like a city. And you could go to New York and I could go to New York and we'll both come back and have totally different impressions of it. But for me, I love projects. I love type 2 fun. I love working. I love creating things. And it's just a huge celebration of that for me. So that's what I get from it. And I love, like we make these mutant vehicles, these like really kind of tricked out things that we take there. And then, you know, you kind of tinker away on it with your buddies all year, and then you take it there and deliver it, and you see people interact with it and have fun on it and have experiences on it. And like, that's so gratifying. And that feeling, you know, and it's not like any of that credit comes back to you. They don't know it's your thing that they're climbing around on, but you just look at them having a good time. And you're like, fuck yeah, that feels good, man.
Right, right.
You know, and that, I think Burning Man like runs on that feeling.
Mm.
And so people build things that you just can't even believe. And to go there and see it and interact with it yourself and be that sort of wide-eyed, excited person and like find out what their original vision was and meet the person behind it and figure out, oh my God, how does that thing even move around? How does that, like some big octopus that spits fire, like how does that fire work? And you're kind of like trying to figure it out. And I love it. The engineering, the creativity, and like it really, it's a lot of work, Burning Man. You know, it's not for the, for people that don't want to work. It's a place where it takes a lot of work to put that city together, a lot of creativity, and to be part of that feels great. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. I wanted to get into a little bit because I thought it was, there were some principles and I was listening to them. I guess we don't have time to go through all of them. Some I found interesting, and one, you know, obviously inclusivity and the fact of participation. Like you, I don't say are expected to, you can correct me if I'm wrong. You need to participate. Participation and also gifting.
Yeah.
And we kind of clarified that a little bit last night over text, but it's like gifting of yourself or whatever it is with no expectation of return.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was super, super cool.
Yeah, I think that's like a misperception. You know, a lot of people hear the term gifting as one of the principles of Burning Man, and they think that means like, oh, you walk around and hand out bracelets, and people do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the kind of first level of understanding of it. But I think it applies much more broadly to like, I don't give away stuff at Burning Man. I haven't done that since like my first year, you know, now I build things.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my gift, is like my time and money that I put into building these cool vehicles that then hopefully I bring them there just to provide experiences to other people and to see them enjoy it. And I think that's a really cool, pure feeling. And that's what everybody is doing there, you know? And so the sum total of that with 90,000 people is just this like otherworldly environment and just such a high level of stimulation. Like if you thrive on stimulation, which a lot of us that do this kind of international travel and moto and stuff like that, man, there is no more stimulating place on earth than the playa during Burning Man. It's cool. But, so back to that, I mean, I think, but yeah, I think the idea of, and I think there's some lessons like that can transition into like normal life from that stuff too. Just like, I think a lot of us at this age have had that feeling of like, wow, when you just like kind of cruise around and do good things for other people, it's amazing how much comes back to you. Mm-hmm. But it takes a while. Like if you just run around looking out for yourself, life is hard, man. You know, most people who think that way don't get what they want. You know, the most people who think about other people and do things for other people and without really expecting anything back, find that life lines up for them, you know?
You're kind of leading me down the path here, because the question was going to be, do you take those principles and apply them in your everyday life? And you obviously do. But you said, you know, life is hard. Like, and generally speaking, I think people do tend to look out for themselves.
Yeah.
Like only, exclusively.
Yeah.
It's all about me. And the most experience I've had with that has been, you know, in the corporate sector or whatever, but it's like, it's all about me. It's all about me.
Yeah.
But to your point, I think the more you give, the more you get, but not with the intention of getting, right? It feels good to give. It feels good to contribute to the hive with no expectation of return in your everyday life or in business or anything, right?
Yeah. But it takes a while to develop the confidence in that formula, you know? But then when you have that aha moment, it's pretty wild, you know?
I can think back on my own life and like the evolution of, you know, and I think a lot of it is getting older. A lot of it is having experiences and good and bad experiences. But when you get to a point where you have that aha moment and you're like, oh man, this is what it's about.
Yeah.
Like when I hear about the inception of Moscow, it wasn't, I don't think you were sitting on a bike in Panama or wherever it was. And you're like, how can we make the most money? Cause you'd already made a lot of money. Right. And I didn't sit in my office like, how can I make something that's going to make me a lot of money? I said, how can I do what I love to do?
And
you're like, I want to build, I want to innovate, I want to create. Yeah. And I think when you do that first, when that comes first, the rest follows.
Yep. I think that's right. And I think, I think Burning Man is a neat place to do, have little experiments, you know, and to kind of like, it's like a big Petri dish, you know, and it's a limited amount of time and it's isolated from your other life. And so you can go there and try things. And, you know, I see that a lot. Like we have a camp and vehicles, and I see the business getting ideas from the camp and from the vehicles, and then things from the business being translated into kind of Burning Man and our community there. I see this like tag team between the two things that happens all the time. And in the middle, we have like the Unrally, which is an event we do, not a Moscow event, something we do outside. But it's sort of like our own little mini moto and overland inspired Burning Man that we do in June every year. And that's like a little bit of both worlds. And then you have the Dusty Lizard, which clearly, you know, these events like what I was here for, which clearly could trace its roots back to Burning Man, but is actually totally in the commercial sector. I mean, it's officially a Moscow event and has our flags and banners all over it. So I think it's great to have like, you got your business, and then over here you have your kind of creative Petri dish that you can kind of experiment and try things and just do anything with relatively low consequences, you know?
Cause it, and maybe you can get into the logistics a little bit, but there are camps and then there's attendees, right?
Yeah.
And the purpose of the camps is you create.
Yeah. The camps provide some kind of I kind of summarize it. And I, by the way, just to be clear, I'm not with Burning Man official. I'm just a participant.
Okay.
I'm one of the 90,000. So for me to talk, it sounds like I'm talking authoritatively about how Burning Man is, like I'm just a dude with a ticket, right? Yep. But I think of it as like, you got camps, you got mutant vehicles, you got art, and then you have infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And those are kind of the building blocks. And those are all different avenues for participating in the event. So typically camps have something of value that they provide back to the community. And so that could be a theme, like they have a bar or they're a nightclub or they're a gym or they're a church or they have AA meetings or whatever they're, or they serve breakfast and coffee in the mornings. There's, I don't know how many, there's thousands of these camps. Like you can't even, you won't even see a fraction of them when you go. they all have, there's a roller skating rink, or they serve snow cones or whatever, just kids playground. I mean, this is like everything you can imagine. And so they kind of, you have like a kind of a group, almost like a, it's kind of tribal in a way. It's like a tribe that unites around a theme and like, hey, this is what we want to provide to the community. And it takes money and work to do that. So they pool their resources and they build something. Maybe it's 20 people or maybe it's 500, but they all come together. Maybe they build a huge sound stage and have DJs that come for the week or whatever. None of that stuff that you see at Burning Man is provided by Burning Man. It's all provided by the participants. So okay. Burning Man just creates the infrastructure, you know, the streets, the tickets, the negotiates with the BLM and the sheriffs, creates the opportunity for all of us to go there and do our thing. And that's the infrastructure piece. And then the art is just these huge, massive art installations that you can kind of climb on and play with and interact with that are kind of scattered over this miles and miles of open desert. And there's more of them than you could possibly see in a week. And so people unite to kind of create these art, this artwork also. Some of it takes hundreds of people working all year to pull it off in millions and millions of dollars.
Oh, wow.
And then you have mutant vehicles, which is like what we have. So we have a camp that's dedicated to supporting our mutant vehicles. And that's our contribution to the community. We build these vehicles, we bring them down there, we operate them, and then pack them up and take them home. And so we have a camp of about 50 people. And last year we had about 7 mutant vehicles in our camp. And so that's what we do. We get them there, we set them up, we maintain them during the week, we operate them, we make sure they go to the right places and get lots of people getting on them and getting off of them and having rides, and then bring them back and pack them up and head home. So
I don't want to stick on Burning Man too much, but I'm kind of fascinated by it. Yeah, but one of the other tenants, or it was, self-reliance?
Yeah, self-reliance. Yep.
So when I think about, okay, maybe I was going to haul my camper out there or whatever, you know, I'm just going through this logistically. I'm like, this is in the middle of the desert. You know, I can only have so much water. What about this? What about that? Right? So that just seems, is it a community-based thing? We all pitch in and help each other?
It can be. I mean, I toss around that self-reliance because I think about self-reliance all the time now too, as a, for our business and at events and for myself personally and for motorcycling and like, what does it mean? Like to be self-reliant. And I feel like it's really just like this quest, you know, cause like, you know, self-reliant could be, I don't know how to change a flat, but you do. So I'm going to go riding with you. That could be self-reliant. You make sure you're covered, you know? So it doesn't always have to be this totally individual pursuit, you know? And a lot of times when you have camps coming together at Burning Man, you know, it's like, okay, this person's going to take care of the food and this person's building the shower and this person's going to haul out the garbage. And so it doesn't mean you literally have to build your own shower, haul out your own garbage, cook all, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
There's a lot of different ways to interpret it, but I think it's a neat term. And I think about it a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody's sort of responsible for themselves, and it helps keep out leeches and mooches.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like it gives you a reason to be like, yeah, no, I don't think so. You're not being self-reliant. You know what I mean? It's like, you can kind of say like, yeah, you got to come prepared, you know, in Burning Man, but also in life or on a motorcycle trip or working at Moscow or whatever, the Unrally. I think it's a neat principle, self-reliance.
Good Especially term. If you're out on a trip or even driving out here in my vehicle or taking a trip on the motorcycle, like you can't take everything to cover every possible scenario with you.
Right.
So you got to prioritize. And I would imagine that gets even heavier when you're in another country. So you're like, I can only check so many bags.
Yeah.
I can't have a backup to a backup to a backup. Like,
fortunately, a lot of the stuff you need is available in those other countries too. That's what usually when you find when you get over there, you know?
Okay. So I'm a big, like, I got to have everything.
Yeah.
I got to have first aid kit. I got to have a trauma kit. I got to have tools. I got to have this. I got to have, but you're on your bike. You can only fit so much stuff in there.
Right.
So prioritization comes into place. And then the stuff is only as good as your training.
Yeah.
Right. So then maybe you bring your buddy with you and he's got some backups to the backups. But I think that whole concept of being prepared and preparedness and self-reliance is something that exists in the motorcycle community, but also in your personal life. Everything, power goes out to, I got spare food, to all that stuff. And you know, you travel a lot. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that you have a lot of layers in place to cover that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think I think self-reliance is a quest more than a thing, a specific objective that you then achieve. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think like, you know, we all know like that sometimes running minimal is like super cool too. Like you want to go ultralight. And so you want to be on a smaller bike and ride in really tough terrain. And so you're going to like eliminate some of these things and scale down your first aid kit. And like, am I saying that that's not being self-reliant and you shouldn't do it? I don't think so. You know, I think that's cool too. I, I don't know if I have all the answers, just more like, I think, that you just do your best and you try to move in a direction, a general direction in life towards self-reliance. You know,
you mentioned before, if you're open, honest, and kind, or you go to these countries and 99% of the good things are going to happen to you. I also think, I'll share my own personal experience with self-reliance or sort of allowing things to happen. It can almost free your mind a little bit. So my girlfriend is very much like, I've taken road trips with like a bottle of water in the car, you know? And I'm like, what? You mean you didn't have every possible tool? Yeah, yeah. And so we've gone out even camping and I'm like taking maybe a fraction of what I normally would. And then everything works out. And you're like, man, that was nice.
Yeah.
I don't need to have anxiety about every possible scenario that could happen to me on this trip.
Or did the odds just come up in your favor, but it was actually a bad decision? That's, you know, you can just drive yourself crazy thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
But again, I'm not sure that there's totally a right answer. I think it's just more of a quest. You know what I mean? You never really get there, but it's just something you think about. I mean, like, you nowadays with like inReaches and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is like a lot of your problems can be solved just by hitting an SOS button, and that's self-reliant. You got the device, you brought it, you paid for the service. They're making money. Everybody wins, you know? And so that can be self-reliant. You know, maybe you didn't bring, maybe somebody else brought, you know, a tow rope and a first aid kit and a spare fuel pump and all this other shit, but forgot an inReach, you know, and then had a problem that wasn't covered by the quiver they brought.
One of the Freshline guys, they were talking about a story when they were in the Gobi Desert and they had Global Rescue and a guy broke his ribs or whatever. And they called Global Rescue and they were like, dude, there's a fuel shortage. We can't get to you. So it's like, figure it out.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, isn't that why we got you?
Yeah.
So, but I think it's like, you know, there could be times when help's not coming. Totally. You are the help until help arrives.
Yeah.
But when we talk about in our personal lives, and I guess I'll kind of pivot back to Moscow as we kind of wrap it up here, but in our personal lives, we can be a little more like, hey, whatever, I'm going to go out and do this thing. I'm not going to bring my gear. Hopefully it all works out. In a professional life, especially running a company, do you find yourself, do you have to be a little more risk adverse? Do you got to make like a little more calculated decisions, whether it's product development or whether it's, you know, moving money or resources around versus like, how do I put this? The consequences of say doing it wrong out here by yourself in your camper, you're like, ah, that was a little bit inconvenient versus in your business life, you could go back to one of your fears. Have I let people down by maybe not calculating this or risk assessing this or whatever it is, right? Do you find yourself, maybe there's two separate paths you got to take in your personal and professional life?
I don't know. I see a lot of analogies between the way we travel on bikes and how we run this company.
Interesting.
It feels like one big motorcycle trip to me, and it has from the beginning. And it's like we're, because we don't really know what's around the corner. I mean, isn't that, again, another sort of like just very angsty concept is that you got to have a plan. And yet almost certainly out of the million potential scenarios that could occur, it probably won't be the one that was in your plan. We so know true. That when we make the plan, and yet we have to have it anyway. And isn't that just a source of never ending angst?
That's
but
deep.
Like, I think if you don't have a plan, you'll never get moving, you know, but you have to be ready to like ditch the plan and reevaluate and recreate and have a new plan on a dime, you know? And so to me that fits perfect into business. Like if you just like have a plan and you rigidly stick to it, no matter what the world tells you, you're not going to be very successful. You know, like you got to follow the clues, read the signs, adjust your plan accordingly. Cause you don't know what you don't know when you embark, you know, but that's why I feel like a lot of times you see these like business ventures that are just sort of a business plan that get all this money behind them and turn into these big flops. Cause like they didn't have time to percolate and listen to the cues that are being sent to them by the world and by the marketplace and kind of go through that process that a business has to go to reach its full potential. You know, you just took it at its inception. It's like injecting steroids into this little tiny seedling, you know, it needs to like face some adversity and grow and adjust and look at, you know, yeah, read the tea leaves. You know what I mean? So anyway, back to your question of, I think there's a lot of analogies between the way we ride and the way we run this business. So yeah, we always have a plan. We're thinking a few years out, but we'll change it in a moment's notice.
This business feels like a big motorcycle trip.
Dude, it's like a big motorcycle trip.
And that's amazing.
We're on it together. It's like, it's wild. I think about that all the time. And you know, it's funny because like at Moscow, we actually go on motorcycle trips with the team twice a year. We close the office and we all go out riding together. And it's really interesting to observe how like quickly and smoothly we go from our our kind of work day roles to our writing roles and then back to our work day roles. And mm-hmm. there's so many analogies between the two in the in our business that it just feels, it starts for me now after whatever it's been 11 years, it just feels like one big long trip.
That yeah. has to be amazing. And I think your appetite for risk, we talk about risk, adversity and all that, has to be high. At least it was in the beginning. And back to the plan, somebody asked me, they're like, well, what's your plan B, you know, for if the podcast doesn't work out over, I'm like,
yeah,
there's no plan B.
Yeah.
Like it's whatever. Like yeah. it's just going to work.
Ships.
Yeah, yeah. Burn the ships. Like, and I think that's to your point. Well, I love what you said. We create a plan knowing that that's probably not the plan we're going to use anyway.
Yeah.
It's like, well, wait a minute. Ding, light bulb.
Right. But you got to do it. You got to have it. Cause otherwise you got to get moving. You yeah. need something to walk towards, you know, mm-hmm. and to push for. And, but then if you're, like I said, we all have seen those types of business owners and entrepreneurs that are just so rigidly sticking to their plan and ignoring all the clues. And that's like that's a total dead end,
mm-hmm.
you know? So you gotta be able to embrace both of those.
I had a good friend tell me once, he was like, if it's 51% one way, 49% the other, I'll take the 51% and just adjust.
Yeah.
Very kind of loose.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean he's deliberate with his decisions, but it's like, it's just going to adjust.
Yeah.
And not stick to a rigid plan. Even like you said, you're reading the clues and this thing's going down in flames.
Yeah.
Burning. But you're like, oh, but I got to stick to this.
That's what the plan said. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's, and it's the same when you're traveling. I mean, you get out, like, you know, look at we just did a trip. The whole team went down to Baja,
mm-hmm.
you know? And yeah, we left on the trip. I mean, not really thinking we knew what was going to happen inside, but it's like, hey, we're going to get to this point and we're going to meet there. And then we're going to get to this point and meet there. We're going to get to this point and meet there. And it's like, you know, we have 30 people leaving on this trip and they all split up into whatever little groups. And I mean, God, by the end of the week, we were spread over all over Northern Baja. We had groups in the mountains, groups on the Cortez side, groups on the Pacific side. We had injuries, we had breakdowns, we had people getting stuck and getting into terrain that was too gnarly and they had to turn around and go back. Like, it was awesome. And somehow we still all managed to meet up and camp together on the last night. But like, you know, the minute you unleash everybody, it's like, what's that saying about like in battle, no plan survives the first contact with the enemy. Yep, it's the same thing as on motorcycle trips. Yeah. It's like no plan survives the first day of riding.
Yeah.
You know, you get out there and see what's really going to happen and then adjust. And so it's the exact fucking same thing with business, man.
It is interesting because I love your view on things and that with that thought process and with the way you live your life, you're still very successful with it. And by success, I don't mean this amazing camper or however much money you have, you seem very fulfilled. You're like, my life and my business is like a big motorcycle trip. Like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so to be able to speak to people that look at that, they see you on Instagram, they see whatever it is you're doing. They're like, I want that life. Right. Maybe they don't see the behind the scenes of what it took to get to that life, but what would you say to them? What would you say? Like, hey man, like this is me. This is how I am. This is why I'm fulfilled. And here's a little bit of inspiration for you too, right? Here's a little bit of me giving to you back to the Burning Man, you know, with no expectation of return. What would you give them? What sage wisdom, if any?
Well, I don't have like a bunch of like witticisms to pass. It's more like what I would offer them is like full and transparent access to my story.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can take that and it becomes one more data point in their own story. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I don't like, it's not like you should do this. It's more like, well, here's what I did.
Yeah.
And then you can take that information and that becomes a data point. You mix it up with all the other data points and you plot your own course, you know? And like, this worked for me. Like, but that doesn't mean that like everybody just run out and pick your favorite sport and start making a bags for it or something like that. I mean, right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah,
but you gotta be excited about it. I mean, I think to be successful, you, in my old business, I had the experience of making a product that I didn't have any personal connection to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine when it's going well. Anybody can get excited about a business that's doing well. But what happens when it turns tough? What carries you through those periods where you're not making money and, you know, people aren't celebrating your accomplishments? How do you get through those periods when you're not like super proud and invested in what you're putting out into the world? And so I think you can get excited about a lot of different things and a lot of different types of challenges. And for me, this is that, but, I think everybody has to find their own version of that. And cause we spend so much time in our careers, but you know, also it's easy for me. I'm so like, you know, think about like business and the company and products and all this stuff, but it's like people find that sense of purpose through their children or through their church or or through their hobbies, you know what I mean? Or through their causes, like environmental causes or whatever, or, you know, by being of service. Like there's so many different ways to find meaning. So it doesn't mean everybody has to find that from their career, you know, but if you want it from your career, you better find something that you're really passionate about and invested in. At least that's what I did, and it seems to be working.
I made the mistake, and you hit it. Meaning, purpose. I think you sacrificed some of that, or I know I did personally, for titles or comp plan or whatever. And then ultimately, you're not, at least I wasn't, fulfilled at all.
Yeah.
And I interviewed my friend Scott. He runs a jiu-jitsu gym in Evergreen, Colorado, and he was like, dude, because I knew him when he was like starting out and like ground zero, you know, borrowing someone's closet to teach classes in or whatever. And he was like, I would do this if I had one student.
Yeah.
He's like, I love it that much. And to your point, that level of purpose, find something you love, find something where you're willing to drive 13 hours round trip to do this. Right. Like, I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. And I think it comes through that you love what you do. You love making your life and your business is a motorcycle trip.
Yeah.
I mean, that's super inspiring.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad. And I like for people out there that are, you know, thinking about doing, like when people hit me up, I get like emails from people wanting to start a business or they've watched how we've done it and stuff like that. And they have questions to ask. And I love getting that stuff. And I'm like wide open and stoked to help people, and people help me getting this business rolling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, so I don't really put myself out there as like this big success story. I mean, we're doing well at the moment, but there's tough times ahead. That's just like the nature of business, man.
Yeah.
And, but if people are curious about how we did it, I mean, you've seen the blog, you've seen the stuff I put out on Instagram. Like we're an open book, man. Like I'm happy to share my experiences with people and if that helps them on their own journeys, you know?
That's fantastic. I love the fact that you're accessible, right?
Yeah.
People hit you up, like I'm doing this thing. Like, well, let me give you, I don't know how many DMs would you say you get a week?
It's becoming a lot. It's I have help with some of my DMs now and I'm still struggling to stay afloat on them. And so that's one of the things about social media, you know, is like that it does allow you to have these kind of one to many relationships, you know, mm-hmm, which can be a little bit difficult to scale at a certain point, but I'm working on it.
That's awesome.
You know, I try really hard.
Yeah.
So to keep up with it all.
The fact that you're like, hey, Phil, like, would you like to come out? We'll do it for my camper trailer.
Yeah.
Like, dude, what? Of course.
Yeah.
Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. No, I want that. And I want to be, one of the things that's been so great for us at Moscow is just like, I think a lot of people, a lot of businesses have a curtain that they sort of hide behind. And a lot of times that curtain is marketing and branding. You know, it's like they've put a lot of time and research into trying to figure out what you want them to be. And then they spend an equal amount of time and money trying to tell you that they're that, whatever that is.
Right.
But it's like totally phony, you know? And I think for us, it's been more of a 10-year mission to just dissolve the curtain. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that is also a type of marketing. It's like, we're not like, this is just us and who we are, man. And we put it all out there, you know? And that includes the foibles and mistakes and the whole process of building the business is all documented in the blog. And I'm happy to, I love chatting about business with people.
Yeah.
People got starting a business and I can help in some way, man. I'm all about it.
I love that. I think that authenticity, you know, got the shirt, be authentic. I think that's something that I recognize and I recognize in you guys and you're like, this is who we are, man.
Yeah.
This is who we are. No curtain. You see what, you know, you get what you get.
And you know, what's a great thing. If you do that and you put that out there and your brand becomes that. So your brand is a real genuine representation of who you are as people. Other people, like-minded people, see that and they come around.
Mm.
And suddenly you look around, you realize like, whoa, man, check it out. Like, look at all these awesome people that were around. Like, this is like our people, you know?
Yeah.
You build a tribe. And like, that's a great, great feeling. And I feel that with Moscow. I felt it at the Dusty Lizard last weekend. You know, it's like that thing that you put out there in the world becomes a bat signal. And other like-minded people respond to it and they come around. And then suddenly you find yourself just like surrounded with like-minded, cool, awesome folks. And like, that's a service that a brand can provide that's like really, really cool.
Yeah.
You know?
That's super cool, man.
It can be a gathering point.
The whole concept of community, everything from Burning Man to the Lizard to the Unrally.
Yeah.
Everything. And your banner's high and people are kind of flocking around it.
I love it.
Isn't it crazy to see what you've built?
Yeah, it's a trip. It's a trip. Yeah. But we're not done. I mean, we're still like, we're building, and we'll never be done, man. This is just like a big creative project. We're not done, you know? But yeah, I love it. I'm so proud of what we built. And it's like, because I'm out talking a lot to cameras or whatever, then people credit me with it. But like, man, the team, the Moscow team, like the people on it, like that's where the credit is really deserved. Like this is like really a team effort, you know? And sometimes I feel a little guilty when people come up and they're like, oh my God, you know, like I get credit for some product or for some event or something like that. And I'm like, in my head, I'm just immediately translating like, yeah, but they, you know, that's these guys.
right.
But that's just how it is, I guess, when you put yourself out there like this. Mm. But really, I think what we've got is a team of people that are really like honestly just on this mission to do the best job we can.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, man, we got to do the mandatory selfie on camera.
Okay.
It's becoming a thing.
Okay.
We'll leave it in on the video too.
I want a copy of that before you go.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. So Pete.
Yeah.
I really thank you for your time. Fantastic episode. I just, you know, I think especially we just met an hour and a half ago and you're like, nah, I got to have an hour and a half engaging conversation with this person I just met.
It's easy. You're really good at this.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you, man. Yeah. Thank you. I mean,
thank you.
That means a lot. You probably don't need it for me, but I wish you guys all the success in the world. I think you have a fantastic brand and product, and I love to see people rallying around your flag and authenticity. Super cool stuff.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. And same to you. This is really cool. It's neat to be part of it. And I can't wait to see what comes of this whole adventure you're on.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, hopefully my life will be like at a giant motorcycle ride.
Well, it sounds kind of corny, doesn't it?
It does. Tagline. My life's like a giant motorcycle. I'm constantly running out of gas. I don't understand. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, good stuff.
All right.
Guys, thanks for watching. Pete with Moscow.
Bye-bye.
Shake your hand.
Cheers. Cheers.